which is the first historical period after the Jews entered the land, after the period of Moshe Rabbeinu. The period of Judges is the period from the time of Yahushua, when Yahushua takes over as a leader, all the way through until the first king was appointed, who was Saul. It's approximately 400 years. And at that time, the Jews did not attain the full unity that they were supposed to in terms of the political system, in terms of establishing a king. And there was, you know, a significant division amongst the Jews. It was also, in general, the period of Shevetim was a time in which the Jews were not on a high spiritual level, and from time to time would sink into the sin of idolatry. And whenever that happened, God sent an enemy to attack them, and in response they would do tshuva, and they would appoint a leader. That would bring about a state of unity, and that leader was the shofet. The term shofet means judge. And therefore the leaders, and some of the great heroes of that period are the shofetim. For example, Shimshon Hagibor, Shimshon the Hagibor, Shimshon was a shofet. And Gideon, in English it's Gideon, but Gideon was a shofet. And any others come to mind? Shmuel, of course. Shmuel HaNavi was the shofet. He was the last of the shofetim, and he was the prophet who anointed Shaul to be the king. That's a separate story in its own right. Now, one of the shofetim was a woman. Was Devorah. So, this is in the early period of the shofetim, and the Jews were surrounded at that time by enemies. And if you take up, where does it begin with? I have from the Tanakh. Where does the Haftarah begin with? Okay, now the proceeding, I'll give you the proceeding. That is really Pasuk Dalet of the chapter. It is chapter 4 in the book of Judges, Shoftim. So the first four, the psukim that you don't have are, it says the Jews continued to do that which was evil in the sight of God, and Ehud had died. Ehud was the prior shofet. And once he died, once they were no longer under the guidance of the great leader, they continued to sin. And God gave them over into the hands of Yavin, who was the king of Canaan. And his general, he had a great general whose name was Sisera. And he was a very mighty warrior, this Sisera. And he oppressed the Jews to a tremendous extent. And finally, under the force of the oppression, the Jews cried out to God. So that was the classical pattern, that because of the pain they were going through, the Jews did tshuva, and they cried out to God. This is where the story begins, your story begins. And Devorah was a woman who had prophecy, Nevi'ah. Right, so she was an extremely high level. She reached the level of prophecy. And she judged Israel at that time. She was the judge. Now this is, I'm not going to pick up the entire issue, but this is it becomes a big problem, because how could she be the judge? On the Sanhedrin, when we have the regular system, the court system, a woman cannot really be on the Sanhedrin. And here, not only it's saying she was the chief justice, so to speak. So there's all different types of explanations. Some hold that she was the greatest Torah scholar of her time, which is an interesting thing. It shows you that in our system, we don't just go by authority. We go by knowledge. If it should turn out that an individual, and it could very well be, that a woman should be the greatest Torah authority of the time, her knowledge of Torah would be greater than any man. So we'd have to go by her, decision, by her understanding of Torah. It's not discriminatory in that sense. It's just the way the system is established in terms of the society. That's part of the story. In terms of society, that's not the woman's role. Tosis is an answer. Tosis says that she actually did not sit on the Sanhedrin, but she would sit outside of the Sanhedrin. And when a difficult case came up, they would confer with her. And they would listen to her decision. But the actual implementation, they would do it. She was sort of an advisor. Now, others say no. Others say that she actually performed the function, but she was permitted to do so because of extenuating certain needs of the time. when it's impossible to function otherwise, so then it's permitted even for a woman to be the judge, whatever the case may be. But of course, you see from this that she was a prophet, and also that she was the leading Talmud Chacham of her generation. All right. And then it states that she, where she dwelled, under the palm tree of Devorah, between Ramah and Beis El, and all of the people of Israel came up to her for judgment. So she was the great Talmud Chacham of the time. And when any person had a Shiloh, when a person had a Shiloh in those days, that's the place they traveled to, and they asked her the Shiloh. Interesting phenomenon. Now, then it says that she sent and she called for Barak ben Avinoam. Okay? Barak ben Avinoam from Kedesh Naphtali. And she said to him, "Behold, God, the God of Israel, has commanded, go and gather an army to Mount Tabor. And take with you 10,000 men from the children of Naphtali and Zebulun. And God will bring to you, will cause Sisera, the commander of Yavin, and his army at Nahal Kishon, and he will give them into your hands." In other words, she was that's why it tells us at the beginning that she was a prophet. She now commands Barak, who was one of the great men of the time, that God has communicated that he is to gather an army of 10,000 men and to do battle with Sisera, and that he'll be victorious. And God will, even though Sisera was more powerful, because the Jews were under the subjugation of Sisera, but that was the command of God, to gather an army and meet them at this particular place, and God will give them over into their hands. You'll be victorious. Now, all this so far, everything is fine. There's no problem. But the next part becomes difficult. What did Barak say? Barak said, "If you'll go with me, then I will go. But if you don't go with me, I won't go." Okay? And she said, she answered him and said, "I will go with you. I'll go with you. However, it will not be to your glory. It will not be glorious to you on the manner that you are choosing to go. Because in the hands of a woman, God will give over Sisera." That's what she said. And Devorah got up, and she went with Barak to Kadesh. Those two psukim is what I'd like to analyze. Just those two psukim. What is difficult about verse 8? And what is difficult about verse 9? There's a lot of problems over here. We just took this up on Friday in Yeshiva when we were analyzing the questions. So let's see if you can spot the problems. As you know, the rest of the story, the Jews had a tremendous victory. I just want to make certain things clear. She went with Barak. Barak was the general. She went with him, and they achieved a tremendous victory. You know how Sisera met his end. At the hands of a woman, Yael. That's the famous story of Yael. And he was running, the army was totally defeated, and he was running for his life. And this woman, Yael, saw him coming, and he was exhausted. She invited him into her tent, and she pretended to be on his side, that she wanted to help him, and she gave him all kinds of refreshments and food that would make him tired, like the dairy type of milk and things like that, until he was exhausted and he fell asleep on her bed, and she took the pegs of the tent and drove him through his temple and killed him. Now, I just want to clear up there are those who learn, the question is, what does it mean that in the hands of a woman, that God will give over Sisera into the hands of a woman? Now, some interpret this to mean there's a reference to Yael. Okay? I don't accept that interpretation. There's an alternative interpretation. Yes? I disagree with that interpretation. Although I'm saying it's feasible if you want to learn that. There are those who learn that way. Because, you see, if her argument was that it's preferable that you go on your own, right? But that if I'm willing to go with you, it's a funny kind of an answer. That's why we're going to analyze that in a minute. Her answer is very strange. But before we get to that, her answer is that if I go with you, then it will not be to your glory, because then God will give over Sisera into the hands of a woman. Why would that affect the fact that Yael, you understand? Why her going along, why would that cause Yael to become the heroine? I mean, that has nothing to do with her. That's something else. My interpretation is that she's referring to herself. So we have to understand that. Because if it was God's intention that Sisera should be defeated by Yael, so then what difference does it make whether Barak goes alone or Barak goes with Devorah? I mean, it doesn't seem to have any bearing on Yael playing her role. Moreover, when we're talking about the credit for the victory, we mean the defeat of the army, not the killing of Sisera per se, right? Because that's something else. Yael got the credit for killing Sisera per se, but by that point, you know, the Jews were victorious anyway. It was a separate thing that he was defeated. That's a separate idea. There's an importance to that idea, because in the Shira, the song that she composed to extol God for the victory, she does sing the praises of Yael. And the fact that Yael killed Sisera, that Sisera met his demise at the hands of a woman, is very significant. There's a very significant point there. But that's not the victory. The essential victory is the fact that the army of Sisera, not the Sisera personally, because the commander can fall in battle and the army can still be victorious. So, but they say like this. They say that, because the prophet says that in the hands of a woman, God will turn over Sisera. So it's a reference to Sisera himself. I'm saying no. In this case, by Sisera, it means the army of Sisera. It's not a reference. It means that they'll be defeated. Yes. And it doesn't mean anything. The leader himself can be killed in battle, and he can still be victorious in battle. I was mentioning to you the case, if you remember the case of Entebbe. Remember when the... Yeah. May have been before your time, I don't know. It was in 1976. Yeah. Right. For those of you remember, that was a tremendous victory. But does anybody remember who was the leader of the commander unit? Yeah. Yonatan Netanyahu, whose brother now is very famous, Benjamin Netanyahu. He became a very powerful figure in Israel. But his brother was the individual. He was an outstanding, he was a great soldier. I read about him. He was one of the top guys in the Israeli army at the time. He was slated for greatness. He was definitely going to be the chief of staff, and you know, everybody expected him to be a tremendous figure in Israeli politics and the military and so forth. And he led the raid. The raid was extremely successful. It just so happened, unfortunately, a tremendous loss, but accidentally, he was the only fatality amongst the attacking forces. Some Ugandan guard shot from the tower and happened to hit him in the back. But he was victorious. The raid was victorious. So I'm saying over here that this is the way I'm learning. That Devorah told him that if you go with me, then the glory will not be yours, because in the hands of a woman, God will give over Sisera into the hands of a woman, is a reference to her, Devorah. Devorah, because she was referring over here to the essential victory, not to the killing, not to the death of Sisera per se. But what's difficult about Pasuk 9? Barak. What's the problem with Barak over here? Yeah? Yeah. Yeah, the essential, right, exactly. The essential problem is, it would seem that Devorah was communicating this as a nevuah, as prophecy. Now, once an individual is established as a prophet, verified as a prophet, and then they come to us, and they say that God told us to do such and such, So then we're obligated to follow the command of the prophet upon pain of death, no matter what it is. Whether the matter be something very significant, whether the matter be something trivial. Whoever fails to obey the command of a prophet is liable to the death penalty. It's a very serious thing. The prophet themselves, if they fail to fulfill the command, no matter what it is, of what God commands us to do, even if it could even be the violation of a mitzvah, because a prophet, a true prophet, cannot change, abrogate a mitzvah. No mitzvah of the Torah can be abrogated, even by a prophet. If a prophet tells us that God has nullified a certain mitzvah, then we know that it's a false prophet, and that person is put to death. But that's only if it's a permanent nullification. There is a concept called Horah Shah, a temporary injunction, so that if a prophet comes to us and says that that God told us to violate a certain one, not to wear tefillin for the next 3 days, so that's a temporary thing, and then we go back, so then we're not allowed to wear tefillin. Because there, it is possible for a genuine prophet to command us on something which would be tantamount to Horah Shah, a temporary violation of the Torah. Now, if that's the case, how could Baruch disagree? It would seem that Baruch disagreed. How could he say that if you go with me, I'll go? And if you don't go with me, then I won't go. How can he say anything like that? First of all, how is he attaching conditions to this? He has no right to attach conditions. I mean, either he believed that she is a genuine prophet or not. Now, if he did not believe, so there, and he was therefore would not go to war, he was afraid that they'd get killed, so then I don't understand why her going would make a difference. Anyway, you analyze, you're going to be caught up in these problems. Seems to be a basic, everything seems to be in a basic contradiction over here. Because you only have two possibilities. Either he believed, we assume he believed in the Torah, either he believed that she was a genuine prophet or he did not. If he believed that she was a genuine prophet, so then there's nothing to talk about. You're obligated to fulfill the command of God. Moreover, how could he possibly have any fear? How could he possibly have any fear? Because that God, she told him that God said, I'm going to give him over into your hands. He is going to lose. He's going to be defeated. So if that's the case, what's the problem? He should have been very happy to fulfill God's command. What does he need her for? God didn't say to take her along. Now, on the other hand, if he was afraid that they'd get defeated, so then what is her coming along going to make? Then he should have said no. In which case it would indicate that he wasn't a true believer. He wasn't a true believer, so then they should have been defeated. Moreover, what's strange is her response. What's strange is her response. Yeah. The thing is that if she was needed, if she was actually necessary, then there shouldn't have been a problem. Then she should have said, I'm going along with you. Or that's part of God's command. I should go along with you. She rebukes him. Her answer is difficult, because what I would expect would be that she should rebuke him and say, God commanded you. That's the command. And either you have faith in God or you don't have faith in God. If you have faith, then you have to go. And on the other hand, if he is refusing to go along with the command of God, then what is she saying? I'll go along with you, but you won't have the glory. Forget about the glory. How are you going to be successful? It means the man is in violation. If he's in violation, he's in chayv nisa, he should be put to death. Her answer does not make any sense either. His question doesn't. His position doesn't make sense, and her answer doesn't make sense. On the other hand, and also, she's reluctant to go, but she's not reluctant to go because it's a violation of God's command. That's not what she said. She brings up this other issue about the glory. Who can? What does that have to do with? What does she mean by that? That's another thing I'd like to explore. Who cares about the glory? What does that have to do with anyone? So, excuse me. Before we go any further, why is she bringing in this issue about the credit? Who's going to get the credit? What difference does it make? Who is going to get the credit? Why is it important that he get the credit? That doesn't seem to be an issue.
The important thing is for the Jews to be delivered, right? The important thing is for the Jews to be delivered from the from Sisera. So, he didn't seem to care about the credit. He knows the same thing. He knows that too. He's not stupid. Baruch was an intelligent individual. He was a great man. He was probably the strongest individual, the leader that the Jews had, who was capable of carrying out this mission. So obviously he wasn't an egotist. That element is fine. He's not an egotist. He wasn't interested in the kavod, and he was very happy to have her along and let her have the kavod. So why the whole thing doesn't seem to really be a major issue. What should be there, the real objection of Devorah, that is to say, that that's not the plan, that you're in violation of God's command. God commanded you to go and you to gather, and these are the people, 10,000, this is the place, that has to be fulfilled. That's what you're supposed to do. I'm not included in the command. Because if she was included in the command, then it would have been clear that I'm going with you. She would have told them, I'm going with you, and we're both going to wage war. That she leaves out. That's not a problem, and that doesn't bother her. On the other hand, the issue that she does bring up, that she's reluctant to go along, but I will go along, but I don't want to go along because the glory will be given to a woman. So what? Baruch doesn't care about that. That shouldn't be a problem. She's not interested in the glory, obviously. He's not interested. No one's interested in the glory because they're all tzaddikim. So the glory will go to God. The truth of the matter is, to whom does the glory belong? To God. And afterwards, she sang a song. That's a shira. Similar to the shira that Moshe sang, Az Yashia Moshe, that Moshe sang after the Kriyas Yamsuf. And Ashir Lashem to go, God. Sang praises to God. Because of it was a tremendous expression, a revelation of the divine might. Everybody saw clearly that God rules the world. And that, so who got? Moshe didn't get the credit. Did Moshe didn't get the credit for Kriyas Yamsuf? So the truth of the matter is, this whole issue, it's better this way. It's better that, I would say that in that respect, it's better. Why is she complaining that you won't get the credit? It's better that he doesn't get the credit, because the true credit belongs to God. That there are 10,000 men, they're weaker, they're the weaker party, and under the direction of God, they're going to do battle against one of the mightiest forces with horses and chariots, a mighty army, and they're going to be defeated. So the glory should go to God. Who cares about the glory over here? Those are my questions. So Marion wants to suggest that he's saying for the morale of the army and so on and so forth. But before you go any further than that, I'm going to raise these problems. First of all, who cares about the morale of the army? And secondly, how does he have the audacity to say lo elech? He's not making suggestions. He's saying, I won't go. That's my question. How can he then he's refusing to go? If that's the case, the person is, in my opinion, is chasidism. If God told you, let's assume we have a situation today, Israel is surrounded by a mighty coalition, whatever the case, and from all intents and purposes, we have no way to fight them back. But then a genuine prophet, someone who's been established, verified as a prophet, God says, I want you, you name the person, to take this unit and that unit and this place and attack, and you'll be victorious. Now at that point, then you think it over logically, and you say there's no way we can win, and you refuse to go. So what do we have over here? It's disobedience to the command of God. And, it's not for you to say you're going to win or lose. You do so, yes, when there's no prophet, when we don't have a message from God, then we're obligated to use our own reason. In that case, if the leading military authorities said it's hopeless, we're better off retreating, whatever the case is. That's a different story. Then you're right, we don't fight. But if you have a specific command from God, then it's a test of your emunah. Then you must go. Now, your point is that he was merely suggesting morale. These things are very, very nice. But he said, lo elech. He's saying, I won't go. How could he say lo elech in the face of a command of God? Yes? Relevant part in terms of the... this week on Shabbos, by the way, I hope you're all prepared with the babysitters because you have to go to shul this Shabbos. It's Parshas Amalek. In this week's Parsha, Parshas Amalek, you're familiar with the story that Amalek attacked the Jews, and Moshe told Yeshua to choose men to fight against Amalek, but then he went up on a mountain, and it's very interesting. It says that Moshe would raise his hands. When he raised his hands, and in prayer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then the Jews were victorious. They'd be winning. But when he put his hands down, then Amalek was stronger. And the day Moshe kvedim, Moshe's hands became very heavy, so they took a stone, and he sat down, and they supported his hands. So it's a very, and if, and his hands were faithful, in other words, he was able to keep his hands up, and as long as his hands were up, the Jews were victorious until sunset, and they finally destroyed Amalek. But that itself is a very difficult thing, but we've discussed that. Chazal asked, did the hands of Moshe wage war? As most people today would, of course, interpret it that way. It's a mystical Moshe has magical powers, and he lifts his hands, and the enemies are smitten. That's how most people. Yeah, but you see that the Chazal didn't believe in that kind of stuff. They did not believe that it operates that way, even with Moshe Rabbeinu. So from this, you can learn a lesson to everybody that else, because everybody else is inferior to Moshe Rabbeinu. So no matter how great a person is, how much of a tzaddik he is, or you think him to be, he doesn't have any mystical, magical powers with his hands to do anything, to stretch out his hands and do something. It means to say, no, Chazal answered the question. And they say that when they looked at Moshe, they subordinated, they subordinated their hearts to their Father in heaven. And in that framework, they were victorious. It wasn't a mystical thing. So as long as Moshe's hands were up, that gave them strength. Or Moshe's hands were down, so they lost the strength. But it wasn't a mystical kind of thing, that the hands of Moshe were actually. That would be difficult altogether, because if that's the case, then why do we have to fight? Let Moshe keep his hands up. If it's some magical kind of a thing, so Moshe could just keep his hands up, we don't have to go to war. Yeah, 100%. So therefore, it didn't operate that way. But that did not, you would think, it's interesting, but they did not have that in the case of Devorah. In other words, the plan was not for someone of that status, you know, she wasn't on the same level as Moshe, but now she would be the Gadol at that time. But that was not the idea. That was only in that war that Moshe kept his hands up. In subsequent wars, the Jews fought, Moshe did not keep his hands up. It was especially for Amalek. Yeah, well, Sisera was pretty much Amalek. Even the war against Amalek, they didn't have that phenomenon. When Shaul fought against him, Shaul was the one who fought the war against Amalek. And he didn't kill Haggai. And that's the time, that's where Haman comes from, the Magad. Because he didn't kill him. Again, the basic problems are, I don't know that I took this up the last time we did this, that must have been many years ago, when we go to now. The attitude of Barak. How dare Barak say, if you don't go with me, I won't go. That's insubordination. She conveyed the command of God. The command of God did not entail, she was not involved. The command of God was for him, go and collect 10,000 men from Manasseh and from Zvulun, excuse me, from Naphtali and Zvulun and to this particular place, etc., and that's it, you'll be victorious. That is all he needs to know. If it comes from God, it's all he needs to know. Either you believe or you don't believe. If you believe, so you should be very happy. No problem whatsoever. We'll go fight, because I have a guarantee. I mean, the Torah demands, and there's a law, you know, called Mochanas Mitzvah, that there are certain situations. The Torah's attitude is, of course, that war is not a positive thing, it's not a good thing, but the Torah is not pacifistic. There are situations where we're obligated to fight. For example, it's called Mochanas Mitzvah, when the Jewish nation is attacked. So it's obligatory to fight a war, to defend ourselves. In that situation, everybody who is eligible is obligated, it's a mitzvah, to go and fight, and must do so, and not even knowing whether you're going to be victorious or not, it's possibly going to lose. Nevertheless, the Torah commands us and expects us to go out and do battle. If that's the case, how much more so when we have a separate, because God doesn't guarantee you're going to win every war. It depends upon other factors. Here you have a guarantee from God that you're going to be victorious. So what's the problem? Why does Barak have a problem? What Jackie is suggesting is that it's a question of actually whether he could do it without her or not. But then I would imagine, if that's the case, you're obligated to go ahead and do what you, let's say he goes and nobody wants to go with him. So then they're refusing. I mean, he's done his part. Let's say he would go ahead and try and mobilize an army, and everybody chickens out. Then he'd have a right to come back to the voter and say, I don't have an army. I did my, I'm prepared to go. I did my part. And then the other people are hired. So it's, you're on the right track, but we have to work on it a little bit more. What Laurie is saying would justify his suggesting why it's better if you come along. That's fine. But that would not go so far enough to explain to us why that would give him the right to say, if you don't go, well, who gave him the right to make these decisions?
You're not satisfied when you say you're not satisfied
with the whole nation. But God said you'll be victorious. Read our command carefully. I set it up. I set it up very specifically. It's not a, you know, it's not a simple problem. The problem is very complex. The problem that we have over here is that she communicated to him the instructions of God, and part of the instruction, part of the Nebuah was Unasatiyu b'yadecha. That's in verse 7, Zion, to gather the armies at this place, etc., and I will give them over in your hands, which means that you'll be victorious. The problem we have is that how could he say he wouldn't go if he's confident? He has to be now totally confident of victory. There's no way that he can't win. When God told Devorah's message, that you should do such and such, and that if you do such and such, you will win, does that mean that there's no way that he could possibly lose? No one was saying this. Now, the simple... Well, I'm saying like this. What exactly was he guaranteed? How did he interpret his mission? Does that mean no matter what I do now, I just get 10,000, I can get 10,000 schluppers, anything I want, just go there, in any type of, any fashion, anything I do, just go there and I'm going to win? No. That's not what it means. No, if that's the case, what does it mean? It means that that's not the way the Ashkacha operates. That's not what God was telling him. God has chosen you to implement, that's right. He had a mission to perform. And it means to say that if he uses his intelligence and his military expertise, and he works out the best possible plan, so then you have a haftacha that God will be with you and you'll be victorious. That's something you have no way of knowing. It means that we have this idea that God works for us, you know, everything works in a magical kind of universe. You know, if we just believe in God, boom, you know, miraculous, God says go there, you go there, and everything happens by magic. Now, nothing over here happens by magic. It doesn't work that way, in my opinion. See, it says about David HaMelech, but he David b'chol derech of maskil, that David was, in all his ways, he was a maskil, he used his seichel, he used his intelligence, b'ashamimo, and God was with him. So why did he succeed? He succeeded because God was with him. Because ultimately, no matter how intelligent you are, right? No matter how well organized, you can't control all the phenomena. It's impossible. You need the help of God. But God only, the hashgacha of God, the providence of God, will only relate to you if you are on a level where everything you're doing is objective, is intelligent, is rational. You're totally in line with God's plan, with God's will. Then God is with you. So therefore, let me give you an illustration. Let's assume that Israel was facing the coalition that went against Iraq. Same type of thing. Now, in purely, we didn't have any Nebuah. In purely human terms, in terms of our own understanding, we'd analyze it, we'd say it's impossible. You know, it's impossible for, no matter how terrific the Israeli army is, they can't take on that type of a coalition. It's just an impossibility. All right. But let's say we had a Nebuah. And Nebuah would come to us, to Rabin or Shamir, whatever it was, and God says to gather together an army and to attack. And I will give them into your hands. Now, what would the Israeli generals have to do? Let's say they were going to obey. Would that mean they just go out there and do any kind of stupid plan? And no, it means to say they still have an obligation. It doesn't mean that anything you do now, you're going to win. If you go out there in a stupid way, you don't use your intelligence, you're going to lose. It means, however, that you've worked out the best possible plan. The most intelligent. Use all of your intelligence now, whatever the case may be. You see, in the case of Abraham, when he fought With 300 and, how much, 19? With the, he fought against the coalition, you know, to save Lot, to save his nephew Lot from a coalition, of the four mighty powers. I think it's 300 and some odd men. And he was victorious. It means he worked out the best possible plan. But the fact of the matter is that without the Ashkacha, without the providence of God, he would have been defeated. And the same would be true. That if Israel goes up against the coalition with the most brilliant military plans in the world, purely in terms of the natural forces, they can't win. I mean, they just have overwhelming might. They just keep dropping bombs and bombs. I mean, they could drop a bomb for every Israeli. There's no way. Oh, but with the help of God, then they can win. But they can only be zochet to the help of God if they're operating in the most intelligent fashion. If they just go ahead and act foolishly, that's it. That's not the promise. So what I'm saying is that Barak ben Avinoam was a mammon. He believed that he would be victorious. But he analyzed the situation. He had a right. All it meant is that he was charged with this mission of taking 10,000 men, but he had to organize them and to lead, to draw up a battle plan which would be the most effective. And in doing so, he came to the conclusion that she was essential. That was his decision. No, because he said that, no, his interpretation is that that I'm going to be defeated. If I go up in a stupid way, I'm going to be defeated. That's not the command of God. It would be like saying, just go up there singing a song, whatever, with 10,000 men, and no, they won't be defeated, then we won't win. We have to, I am only guaranteed a victory if I work out a plan which has the best possibility. Now, according to his understanding, she has to be there. He demands her presence. He's only demanding her presence because he believed that her presence was essential. And in a similar fashion to the case of Moshe Rabbeinu. At that time, the Jews were incapable of fighting without the presence of Moshe Rabbeinu. Because Moshe Rabbeinu symbolized to them the idea that God controls the entire world. The idea is that we shouldn't be afraid of human might. That there is no such thing as human might. So when they saw, they really should have internalized that idea. They shouldn't have needed Moshe Rabbeinu. But at that time, they were on a level where they had to see it personified in Moshe Rabbeinu. All right? Now, if that's the case, anybody that knew that would have known that they couldn't go out and battle against... Now, without Moshe Rabbeinu, they would have been defeated. Where's the Ashkacha? Even with Moshe Rabbeinu, do we believe that they defeated Amalek because of their own might? The Ashkacha was with them. But it meant because they were fighting in the best possible way. But if they stopped fighting, if they gave up, if they couldn't raise themselves to the level where they were giving their best and fighting their best, and they would have lost. The whole situation would have been different. Now, it was his analysis that just like the Jews at the time of Amalek with Moshe, they needed the presence of Moshe Rabbeinu. His analysis was that they had to have the Torah. He understood the situation. And perhaps he didn't see it that way. That's a valid machlokus. No. That's not true because... That's not true. A Navi does not know everything that's going on.
Okay.
That's not the case. But I'll show you the proof of that because it says that, but Yaakov said that he thought that Yosef was killed, right? That a wild animal. He said, I'll go down to his grave mourning. But it said that from the Pesukim, it's clear that Yitzhak knew. Yitzhak knew the truth, that he was really lost in the Navua. But he didn't tell. He didn't tell Yaakov because he knew it was God's plan. So the question is, if he knew Sinavua, Yaakov was also Nevuah. How come Yaakov didn't know? How come Yaakov didn't know Sinavua? So the answer is, that even though a person is a Navi, it doesn't mean that he knows everything that every other Navi would know. Each Navi is on his own level. At certain times he's on the level, sometimes not. Doesn't mean that what one Navi knows, the other one necessarily will know. So let me just tell you my point. You don't have to accept it. My point is that his analysis of the situation was that he knew that these were from his own tribe, by the way, from Naphtali, I believe. Would he come from which tribe? Yeah, Kedesh Naphtali. He lived amongst these people, so that he knew these people better. And see, what she was saying was, her point was that you should reach the level, you should be able to reach that level where you don't need me. That would have been the ideal. Apparently, he reviewed the situation. He was totally honest. He wasn't interested in any. He was not interested in glory. His decision was that we cannot, I can't do it, I just can't do it. I can't inspire them. Perhaps he was saying that you should reach the level, this is an opportunity for you to rise in stature. Sometimes a person like a vice president becomes a president. So he was mediocre. But now the challenge is to rise to the occasion. Very often, in history, that happens. That the opportunity makes the individual. He rises to a higher level. So what she was saying is that you should rise to that level where you're able to inspire them. His point was that I can't do it. I need you. Now, if that's why when he said, if you don't go with me, I won't go, he was saying because then it's, we're not going to win. We're not going to be able to fight properly. And if we can't fight properly, so then we're going to be defeated. Because God's promise was not that no matter what we do, we're going to win. God's promise was that if we join together and we fight in the most effective manner, then God will help us. That's the idea of the victory. That's how he interpreted it. And she didn't deny it. So the next point is, what was her objection? This business is about the glory. Who cares about the glory thing? See, she, that's why that answers. See, if she held that he had no right, if this was insubordination, to say, I won't go, then she should have said, you have to go. Okay, she rebuked him. She said, no, it's better that you should find within yourself the strength to be able to inspire these people. Basically, the necessity was for some type of inspiration. Now, without that inspiration, they wouldn't be able to perform their mission. Without them performing their mission, they'd be defeated. That's why he's saying, well, anyway. His conclusion was he can't do it. Whether he was right or whether he was wrong, that was his conclusion. He had no choice. But to be honest, so now what was the issue, though? What was the objection? That you will not get the glory? You will not get the glory? Who cares about the glory? The glory is really to God. That's what I'd like to answer now. Lori? When he's saying I'm not going to go, it means to say that I'm no longer bound in the same way as if he went out there and he couldn't get 10,000 people. So he's no longer bound by the command. He did what he's supposed to do. So too, if he could get 10,000 people, but he couldn't get them into to shape them into a fighting force in the proper way, it's the same idea. Now he's saying, I need you. You're appointing me as the commander. Now I, as the commander, am saying, I need you there. Now every commander knows he needs certain people to help him, certain people function for morale, and so on and so forth. So if he held that her presence was a vital ingredient in achieving victory, then he had to have it. Then he had to have it. Now, the only thing is that she was opposed to it, but she was opposed to it for a different reason. Why was she opposed to it? And who cares about the glory? So I would say, all right, let me just explain it a little bit. You see, at that time she was the Shofetes. The story begins with explaining that to us. Now that basically, as I said, if a woman happens to be on the highest level, she has the greatest Torah knowledge, so then you go to her. But there was something wrong. That's not the way God intended the situation. In terms of the way Kol Yisrael is supposed to function, that is not the task of a woman. The task, not that she should have the knowledge. A woman is a bride. The ideal of the woman, the role of the woman, is basically behind the scenes. That's the way it's intended to be. It's basically one of tzniut. It's interesting, the woman is never put down. The woman is never put down. You see in the case with Avraham. The woman has a very, very important role to play. When Avraham, she said to send away, Sarah said to send away Yishmael, because Yishmael was a bad influence on Yitzchak. And it was the matter was bad in the eyes of Avraham. Avraham disagreed. And God said, what did God say? Kol asher tomrei le'asar shema b'kola. Didn't just say to listen in this particular case. Everything that Sarah says, you should listen to her. Meaning in these areas, she has the expertise. But Sarah wasn't looking. Sarah was not looking for any public recognition. That represents, by the way, that's a higher level of perfection. Tznius. Tznius means where a person is doing something lishma, for the sake of the thing itself, and is not looking for any public recognition. That's the real idea of modesty. When a person is not looking. Now, in a society, you have to have people in the forefront for the sake of society. That is essentially the role of the man. The leadership role, even though in terms, that's not essential. And see, today, unfortunately, you have this problem with the whole women's movement. It's always a demand for equality because they really believe there's some value in being out in the open.
being in a public. In Judaism, there is no value. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't want to be the leader. See, that's basically a necessity. But in terms of the proper functioning of Jewish society, this was an aberration. That was not the proper role for women. Now, there were two areas in which she was functioning. What? Why they have? Because of the there was no alternative. The reason why is because there was no choice. When the situation is distorted, so you still have to function. What are you going to do? They didn't have anybody else that was capable. If she was the only one that was capable, it's like a surgery. I mean, that only Elisha. That was. No, because the proper function, the proper role of the woman was basically not to be in the open, in the public position. That was not the proper role of the woman. Now, I would say Shofetet itself wasn't so bad, but she objected to the military role, because the military role is one with a glory. See, like today, that's a thing that's a tremendous attraction, because people have a desire to be in a position of power. That's why the women did the big movement today. The women in the military, not just to be in the military, but to be in combat roles, and you see even in the Gulf War, a lot of them are flying in combat missions. Now that's something which has a tremendous hold. Now that would be bad for the society as a whole. If you begin to open up these avenues to women, so then they're going to be attracted to these areas. Well, that's what I'm trying to say. That's what it gets down to. Now, what she preferred. The fact of the matter is that it's not her job to be the chauffeur. That should be the men are the ones who are responsible. Now, if there's been a breakdown in the system, then so she has to function as a chauffeur. But this should be something which is just temporary. And the situation should be restored to the proper order. Now she she was telling him that there's a challenge. There's a military challenge. He should be the one to lead the nation so that the entire people would see that Barak Ben Aminam is the military leader. And that would restore the situation. But for him to go forth, she was concerned with restoring the situation to the way it should be. For him to go forth with her would be very bad. It would take away from his glory. Because then they'd say that he wasn't strong enough to do it on his own. He needed her. That's why, and she didn't want to take away from his glory. Not for personal. No, for the universal. That the as I said, for the system, for the sake of the society. That's not the woman's role to play. The woman's role is not to be the fighters and the protectors and the defenders. That's part of the man's role. The woman is necessary because you have no choice in order to save Klal Yisrael. But she was telling him that was her last instruction to try and get him to perhaps raise himself a little bit better. In terms of the ultimate victory, in terms of not just defeating Sisera, but in terms of restoring the society to the way it should be, it's going to be better if you get all the glory. That is to say that the society will know that the men are in charge of the military. But if they see a woman out there, it's going to take away from your glory, and that's not going to be the best thing in terms of the interests of society. So that's the way I interpret her answer.